Hi everyone, I'm Emmeline Pat-Dahlstrom from Spacebase, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the space entrepreneurial ecosystem in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Spacebase podcast. Today I'm interviewing Kelly Schnuck, who recently joined the ranks of the Edmund Hillary Fellows from the US. Kelly is a professor of media arts technology at the University of Brighton in the UK. And she has a background in aerospace engineering, music production, audio engineering, and data sonification research. She holds a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics from Stanford University and studied at the International Space University, where we both met a long time ago. She spent two decades as a NASA research scientist with a focus on Mars and the moon before turning her attention to music full time. In this interview, we're going to learn about her passions, multidisciplinary projects, and how her love for space has brought her to where she is today. Kelly, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So it's been a while since we saw each other, and you've got so many awesome projects that we can talk about. But I think what I suggest is maybe we do the interview in two parts, where we talk about, you know, your career, your transition to a more multidisciplinary, you know, world of space art and innovation. Then as a traditional aerospace engineer and researcher at NASA.
Okay.
So yeah, maybe first off, I guess I'll ask the fundamental question of why you love space and, you know, what got you started?
You know, it's funny. I think that because of the company I keep, people assume that, that I do what I do because of an attraction or a love for space. But I think for me, it's sort of more fundamental than that. I think I have a strong pull to investigate, truth with a capital T or reality. And for that reason, I'm attracted to science and technology and the tools, any kinds of tools or knowledge bases that we have to help us understand who we are, why we're here, how we got here, how everything works. and along this journey, I've been really inspired by people who have made great leaps in that arena, and particularly in people from the time of the Renaissance, you know, where there were no boundaries between these current boundaries we have between different fields of knowledge didn't really exist, and people used whatever they had at their disposal to pursue truth. And I really want to bring back that spirit of a holistic approach to understanding ourselves and understanding the universe. So space is a part of that, because space has a lot to teach us about ourselves and about the universe, and it is the universe. and so it essentially holds all the secrets, but I think a lot of those secrets also are held on Earth. And so I have to say that I'm not more interested in space than I am in Earth. But I'm interested in those things that we can learn from space.
Yeah, well, you talked about the Renaissance, and so is there a particular person that you're thinking about?
Asking me that, setting me up to talk about Johannes Kepler. Yes, I'm kind of on a mission, really, to re-expose ourselves to the way, not only what Kepler discovered, because he is known for his three laws of planetary motion, and this is something that is taught to everyone in engineering and in space science. But what I didn't realize, I think, until about 19 years ago, was the degree to which he used music to investigate reality and to make these discoveries. And so I've been gradually coming to understand the role that music played in medieval and Renaissance times, which was much different than the role it plays now. So Kepler really is my focus, because I've been trying for 19 years really to get to the bottom of how it was that he could use music and, in fact, spiritual principles of truth and beauty and patterns and archetypes and geometry to make his discoveries and essentially launch a whole new field of science. This is super exciting to me. And it's not just Kepler who did this, but he did it in a way that is and was selfless and persistent. You know, there are other people in history who were more genius in their natural and sort of intrinsic capabilities. There were people who were more revolutionary. There were people who were more visible, like Galileo, who was contemporary to him, always gets the credit for the scientific method. But really, it was Kepler and his willingness to just persist and not look primarily for personal gain, but to really pursue truth, is super inspiring to me. And I would love to emulate that spirit in my own work.
Wow. And so how did you discover Kepler? Was it something that you were already fascinated when you were growing up, or was this something that is just that became kind of a focus within the last two decades that you mentioned?
Well, you know, growing up, I was fascinated with music, and I always thought my life would be about music. But then when it came to choose when I was 16, what to do with my life, I was terrified by the idea of my life being dependent on music or creativity. And I didn't really know what it meant, what was possible in the realm of music. And for me, what I thought was possible just felt way too difficult. So I felt like I was choosing the easy road when I decided to do engineering. And I really just did it because it seemed doable, whereas music seemed impossible. And so it wasn't really a fascination with space or engineering or mathematics or geometry that led me to Kepler. What it was I was invited to give a speaking tour, and this was kind of into my career as a NASA scientist, and I was working at the time at Goddard Space Flight Center, and I was invited to Japan by the Baha'is in Japan to give us a public speaking tour on the topic of space and its relationship to our collective understanding of ourselves as humanity. And for me, this topic was so huge, and it was so far beyond what I felt I was really qualified to talk about, that it required me to really dig in, not only to scientific literature and history, but also my spiritual writings that talk about the harmony of science and religion, and talk about this idea of spiritual inquiry being, you know, equal to scientific inquiry. And in the process of studying, essentially cramming for this speaking tour across Japan, I re-encountered the work of Kepler, and I re-encountered the idea of this, of the music of the spheres that kind of dominated the worldview at the time in Kepler's time. And I started to try and understand what that really meant. What did it mean? And slowly and gradually, I realized that music was part of the quadrivium at that time. It was part of the suite of tools for investigation of reality, together with arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. Those four things were the sciences, essentially. Music was a science. And I started to wonder why we don't use it that way now. We use it as a toy, as entertainment, or to sell stuff, or to make people feel certain ways, or just to play with our emotions. We don't actually use it for the investigation, for scientific inquiry. And I immediately became fascinated with that. But that was 2001, that speaking tour, and I've been really on this path since then to try and figure out how can we become a society that uses music in this way again.
So you mentioned, you know, the music of the spheres, and for me, I don't really know much about it. So maybe can you describe to us what exactly you meant?
Yeah, I think the credit for the concept is usually given to Pythagoras, who taught that all things are number, and put forward this notion that there was an intrinsic order to reality that was in its form was harmonic, and that ratios and numbers could be used to describe everything. And before Pythagoras, this wasn't necessarily the worldview. But I think that there were long centuries where the idea either languished or was misunderstood. But Kepler really took this idea that there was an intrinsic harmonic order to God's creation, and he really was centrally focused on understanding God and understanding truth and revealing God's beauty through the workings of nature. And he believed that there was this, not an audible music of the spheres, but a mathematical and geometrical order to the solar system, or in his day, to the whole universe, because there was no difference between the solar system and the universe. It was just all the spheres. But this idea that it could be described through musical harmony, through musical ratios and patterns that have their equivalent in sound that the human is programmed to recognize. And so he was very interested in connecting those, in revealing those harmonies and using them to figure out everything about how the planets moved, like how far away from the sun were they and how fast did they go and in which order were they and what revolves around what. And all of these things are things that Kepler finally was able to put mathematics to. And because up until then, they'd had these extremely convoluted and very incorrect models of the solar system.
That sounds beautiful. So you have this project called Keplercordia. Maybe can you explain a little bit more about this and what you're working on as it relates to your focus with Kepler?
Yes. So from that time in 2001, I started to focus at first quite in the background and on the side, because at the time I was working for NASA and I was also learning how to produce music, but kind of low key, I started really trying to understand Kepler's work and read his original works and really understand how he got to the conclusions that he got to. And so in the process, I started realizing that I would need to educate myself with the latest technologies on how to connect sound and music to science and what would I need to be able to, say, take data and turn it into sound. And the tools that I had at my disposal were the tools that I studied in university, which were very much outdated now, Fortran 77 and that sort of thing. So I started just really slowly at first and then accelerating, acquiring the knowledge and the tools I would need to be able to turn my attention to data sonification. And I didn't really know at first what I needed to do. But at some point, I discovered this concept of shaving a yak, which is super useful to me, which is if you have a thing that you need to do or that you're trying to do, but in order to do that thing, you have to do another thing. And before you can do that other thing, you have to do yet another thing. And there's this chain of things that you need to do, at the end of which it's so far from your original thing that it's like shaving a yak. And so I started to, when I encountered this idea at the MIT Media Lab of yak shaving, I started to think about, okay, I have been shaving a lot of yaks, but I don't yet know what this thing is that I want to build. Mm-hmm. And so I started just embracing the yak shaving for a while. But then at some point, something switched and I decided that what I was going to do was work on the thing, but I didn't know what the thing was. I really didn't know what it was. I knew it had to do with music and I knew it had to do with Kepler and I knew it had to do with science and I knew it had to do with space, but I didn't know what it was. And so I just started going to conferences and speaking about it and telling the story and putting on the table the puzzle pieces. And it was a really kind of a terrifying process to speak about a project as my life's work that I didn't understand and I couldn't really see. But gradually, and right in the beginning of that process, I gave it the name Kepler Concordia, because I knew that naming something is like the first step to creating it, to speaking it into existence. So I had to give it a name. And Concordia means, it means harmonies in Latin. And since this is a project that's really in pursuit of Kepler's, the process that he used to write this book, Harmonies of the World, that he published 400 years ago this year. In honor of that, I called the name of this thing that I'm creating, which is now becoming much more clear, and is which is what I'm coming to New Zealand to build, is a musical instrument platform designed to let people play the universe as a musical instrument. And this project, Concordia, is much bigger than just space. It's really designed to become a platform where you can play any kind of data about humans or about space or really anything in between, from the very, very small to the very, very large, through music, and to use this way of interacting with information and data the way that Kepler did, which is as a tool for investigating reality. So that's really what Concordia is about. That's kind of what I'm up to now.
Oh, fascinating. And what instruments do you play traditionally?
I play the piano. I played piano from a very young age. I play the oboe. I play a little bit of bass guitar. But mainly I play electronic instruments, and I do sound design and production. So that means I spend a lot of time manipulating sound in a computer and using digital tools to create sonic environments. Yeah. So I've been immersed in the world of the physics of sound and the psychoacoustics of sound and the psychology of music, what music does to the brain, all really in an effort to create mappings between information and sound that allow people to feel things that they wouldn't otherwise perceive in data. I feel like this is something that will make our exploration of space very much more powerful, when we have more than just what's available to our eyes to explore. And we have so much data coming back from space now. We have way more than we can really process with our eyes alone. And so creating new ways of understanding our world is what Concordia is about.
Great. And you also have another project called Mimu? Is that how you pronounce
Mimu,
it?
Mimu.
Yeah. Can you talk about that as well?
Yes, this is a very big and beautiful yak in my life. Understanding how we might interact in a visceral way and in a intuitive way with digital media. We traditionally, especially with music, we've had to rely on very limiting tools such as buttons and knobs and faders and whatever you could reach with your fingers, that are also quite impersonal and a little bit difficult to relate to an audience. I don't know if you've ever been to a dance or like a rave or something, or any kind of a electronic music performance, but these usually guys are on stage with behind a laptop doing something. Mm-hmm. You really don't know what they're doing. In fact, you don't really know why they're up there. They could have just been checking their email or playing, just hitting play and then just dancing. I've been working with musicians, particularly with the musician Imogen Heap in the UK, to make the process of interacting with digital media more intuitive and visceral and physical. So we've created so far a pair of gloves and software that allow you to map your gestures to music or sound or lights or really anything that a computer can control. So this is a tool for gestural expression. And many people are using this in a purely creative mode to either write or perform music. I'm interested in it as a very human way of interacting with the data that I'm interested in playing. So a tool for literally playing this data and exploring it, you know, with the body and with in the ways that we interact with physical objects. And so putting this instrument, putting Concordia in virtual reality or augmented reality, and then allowing users to use their own bodies and gestures to interact with the data is a way of immersing people in learning in a way that's never been available to us in history.
Yeah, well, that's actually fascinating. And I think I read that the glove has also been used by several famous artists today already.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And I think when you put them on and you have an opportunity to even make one little choice about how your own movements are going to make something sound or something appear on a screen, the feeling that you get is like you have a superpower. And it's a very exciting future for artistic and scientific pursuits, I think, because it really gives each person agency in the way that they want to explore either their own creative realities or scientific reality.
Mm. So I'm going to shift us a little bit more earlier on in your career. Mm-hmm. And because I know people are fascinated about, what were your projects when you were working at NASA before? And if you could just give us a glimpse of what that was.
Yeah, I think people might not realize that there are different worlds within NASA that often don't necessarily overlap very much. For instance, in my time at NASA, I tended to bounce between the scientists, the science world, and which is typically at NASA falls within the robotic exploration program and then the human exploration folks, which is a completely different part of NASA. Different people, different priorities, different amounts of funding, different levels of, vulnerability to changes in Congress or politics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also kind of way different languages and realities in terms of what's important to them. And so I tended to be in this very small overlapping area between science and exploration. And in fact, when I was at Johnson Space Center, I was in the human exploration science division at Johnson. And so I tended to try to be either the person thinking about science in human exploration context or the person thinking about humans in the robotic exploration process. And that is where I ended up spending most of my energies, thinking about the exploration of the moon and Mars and trying to understand what we needed to do before we sent humans either back to the moon or onto Mars. And then once we were there with humans, what kind of science could we do and how would we do it and what would we need to do it there? And this involved both some theoretical and scientific programs, but it also involved some simulations. So I would go to places on Earth that are like the moon or like Mars and literally try it out, try to do science in a spacesuit or in a lander and not be able to go outside. So there's a whole kind of world in there of this overlap between science and exploration that tended to be where I showed up. I did work at a lot of different NASA centers and including at headquarters. And usually I was trying to bridge these worlds.
Can you remember a highlight or memorable experience that you've worked on when you were there or whichever NASA center?
Well, I remember, there's so much that happened while I was there. One thing that really stands out in my memory is when the field of astrobiology was created. And I remember just how exciting it was to be there at the beginning of this new interdisciplinary field of inquiry, where we were gathered at NASA Ames Research Center. So this was pretty early on. This would have been in the, in the 90s, maybe even the early 90s. I can't quite remember when it was, maybe late 90s, early 2000s. I can't remember when the field of astrobiology at NASA became a thing, but I do remember this gathering of all different people. And it wasn't usual at NASA to have this. We even invited, I think there were people in there that were from the religious communities. And I remember on the agenda was just a discussion of the question, what is life? And it was one of the few times when I was at NASA where it felt like we were actually getting to the big questions that need to be answered in the world. And even though in the NASA strategic plan, it talks so much about these, you know, these fundamental questions, but so often you just get, you're sort of drowning in the administration of it all, or in the day-to-day things. But that's one moment that really felt like lots of different types of people coming to the engineers and the scientists and the biologists and the researchers and people from the outside communities that had an interest or relevant perspectives to offer on this very difficult question, how you define what life is. That I think that's one of the highlights of my time there.
So my next set of questions are more about like recommendations. And so if you go back to your earlier education in life, you know, what particular areas of your sort of your experience or education benefited you the most later on in life when you worked in the space or aerospace industry?
I had the good fortune of meeting man that ended up being my main PhD advisor, Christopher McKay, pretty early on in my graduate work at Stanford. And I was taking a class on Mars exploration, like a project class. And so we went to NASA to interview Chris and Carol Stoker and Larry Lemke and the people at Ames who were working on that stuff at the time. And Chris, it's really hard to talk about him in any sort of a succinct way, but he embodied so many of the principles that I later just kept going back to and going back to and going back to in my professional life. He, whenever I would go into his office with any crazy idea, including I want to go to the International Space University, his response was always, great, how can I help? And this is not a typical way for a PhD advisor to respond, you know, to just And he had this saying. He said the most important thing to get out of graduate school is yourself. And he didn't mean to just get out as quick as you can. He meant to actually find yourself during this time. And he understood the value of, you know, really exposing yourself to every possible thing that you might be interested in, and really exploring the world in a way that's quite unique to graduate school time. And so he was so supportive, really, of anything that I wanted to do, even if it wasn't directly related to my PhD topic or getting something out of it for himself. He was never interested in that. He was mostly interested in me pursuing whatever it was that I was interested in. And I think this is something that I've always held on to. And also, he's pretty much one of the most intelligent people I've ever met, and he somehow managed to successfully resist getting pulled into like management or positions of power, and just was continually focused on research and especially on field work. And he introduced me to this idea of the importance, I guess, of interacting with other people, and also not assuming the worst in people, and taught me a lot about respecting people and how to treat people in the world. Because I think sometimes, and especially in science and technology, we forget that still the world is really about people and about relationships and about love and about things that scientists don't talk about very much. But I watched the way that he would prioritize, say, people over his own needs, and or prioritize science over material gain. And yet he was able to, he knows so much about so many different things. And so I think it was, he's really singularly one of the people in my early development that I still to this day continually learn from, even though I don't really have much interaction with him directly. But I think about him and the principles, I guess, of his approach to exploration and science and the world, and particularly with gratitude for the freedom that he gave me when I was working with him to explore all aspects of the world. Mm-hmm. He's a bit like Kepler in that way, in fact.
And that is great. What words of wisdom would you give somebody, especially females who are interested in space out there, but are not quite sure yet how to begin their career or how to build a career that is focused on space?
Yeah, I think I'm not a very good person to talk about this stuff because I've never prioritized my career as a thing that I want to focus. So I'm not really good at giving career advice. My advice would be, and I don't know if this is generally applicable or if it's just what worked for me, but it's just to actually not think about my career. And that's been the only reason why I've been able to get here where I'm working really on the thing that makes me the most excited and the most, I guess, passionate and focused and fulfilled. I really don't have any standing anywhere, and I don't have a lot to especially money to show for my mm-hmm. for the investment in these ideas. But I think the advice that I would give is that it's always more important how you treat people and how you treat yourself than it is what you're doing. So it's important to find those principles that you like, to really articulate your own fundamental principles of truth, and then live into that rather than thinking about the job or the money or the career or the letters behind your name or really any of that. There are things that you can do that make it easier for yourself, so that give you a leg up. So really fundamentally understanding mathematics and mm-hmm. physics is always a good thing. Yep. Having more letters behind your name definitely gives you an advantage in terms of having legitimacy before somebody's had a chance to form any other opinions of you. But I don't think that those things should ever be pursued at the expense of just fundamental integrity as a human being. I think it's much more difficult, in fact, to be a good person than it is to be a good scientist or a good engineer or a good politician. Like, I think being a good person is one of the most noble pursuits that you can have. And I think it's just in that pursuit that everything else will fall out of that. So I think my advice is to figure out what you think it means to be good and what that looks like for you. And I would never claim to be a good person, but I definitely am not shy about saying that that's really my main, that's my main concern at the moment, is just to try and be good, whatever that means, to figure out what that means, to keep asking what that means. What does it mean to be a good person and to be contributing to solving the world's problems rather than creating more problems? And for me, I think this is a higher priority than any particular career goals.
And what do you think about pursuing passion?
I'm not one of these people that says just dream your dreams and go after your dreams, because I actually think it's really important to connect your dreams very literally and explicitly to the larger pursuits. And if you can't do that, then I think it's important to reassess the dream and figure mm-hmm. out if the motivation is pure. So I think the purity of someone's dreams, that it, like, whether or not I would advise pursuing one's dreams, it depends on the purity of those dreams. If someone's dream is to solve climate change, that seems like in my mind, I can connect that to a very broad goal that makes the world a better place. Mm-hmm. if someone's dream is to be famous, I wouldn't say that, I wouldn't encourage somebody to break their backs, do everything they can just to be famous. Well, particularly because I don't want to be famous, but but more, I can't quite connect that to a sustainability of life on earth or that kind of a goal. So I really think it's important to connect dots whenever you can, to connect dots to principles or very big goals, even if you can't necessarily guarantee that whatever action you're going to take actually will connect to those bigger goals. I think even just the act of identifying those goals for yourself is extremely valuable and will affect, it will eventually affect your day-to-day decisions in a way that gets you closer to something meaningful rather than just whatever dreams might pop into your head. I think humans are fallible and are definitely susceptible to having dreams or aspirations that really aren't good.
I agree. Continual
assessment to what is good. I think that's a, it seems like very trite, but it's an extremely complex question. What's fair? What's just? What's good? What's going to actually contribute to making the world a better place? And those are not easy questions. So actually my main advice to anyone would be to find a community of people who are asking those questions. Even just reflecting on those questions together is life-changing and really can focus or shift your attention when it most needs to be shifted into something entirely new. So the power of community is really, really important.
Yep. And in terms of recommended resources, do you have a recommended either book or resource that you think people should either read, or people that you follow that have kind of like the same values and aspirations as you have?
Well, I think there are these little organic communities popping up everywhere. And some of them are distributed all around the world and some of them are local. For me, I am very much inspired by and I think driven by the principles and the goals of the Baha'i faith. So for me, my religion plays a lot into my own worldview and my own focus. And the Baha'is are engaged in a process of transformation of society that is very beautiful to me, is both centralized and decentralized, and has this kind of magical balance between a global and a local impact, and doing this in a way that has nothing to do with power or control, but really all about community building. I think the processes that the Baha'is are engaged in really hold the key to our future. I think understanding how we can develop our local communities in a way that encourages diversity and where there's a place for everyone, and where everyone of all ages can contribute, and where people are, I don't know, at peace and everyone is looked after. Like, this is something that is a very difficult process. It's not an easy thing, but the way that the Baha'i community around the world is engaged in doing this is very, very inspiring to me. And I'm excited to be a part of that wherever I am. And the fact that I know that I can be a part of that wherever I am, that is in itself pretty miraculous. It doesn't really matter in what country I live or what, there's a community of people that's working on this. And there are multiple communities like this that are inspiring to me. EHF is very inspiring to me for this reason. There's a global space community that I'm part of that's interested in understanding how we can use space to make the world a better place. And you know, I do actually engage in that piece of advice that I said earlier. I'm a member of so many different types of communities, each with their own little thread of things to offer the idea of building a future that works for everyone.
Well, great. Before we close, do you have any other parting words or general recommendations for anybody in New Zealand that might want to pursue kind of the same path as you have?
I would actually recommend that no one pursue the same path that I have. It's really the path of most resistance. But if there's anyone that wants to get involved with Concordia, or really in even more in general with this idea of figuring out how we can use sound together with visuals and immersive experiences in understanding space and then understanding our world and understanding each other and really fundamentally understanding our oneness, then I would love to know who they are. I would love people to get in touch with me. I still don't really know what this is going to look like. So I can't, it's not a specific path, but I would encourage anyone who is inspired by these things to focus on general tools like mathematics and physics and computer science and just basic, and also making, you know, electronics. And these things will always come in handy if you're interested in this use of science and technology and music to make the world a better place.
Thanks so much, Kelly, for sharing your thoughts and insights to the New Zealand community and to our audience. Thanks for listening. If you like our work and would like to support us, please check us out on spacebase.co. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.